So I've gone the full dag to say it's been a while. I've been working internationally, but it's wonderful to have a chance to talk about what's happening in Australia. And what's happening is we have tried very hard to find out a bit more about the mandatory testing laws that are operating in various states. Our focus is on those laws that apply when bodily fluids land on a police officer or other emergency services worker rather than any mandatory testing in any other context or other public health orders. So they're the states that have laws, colour-coded. Victoria's laws are in their Public Health Act, and I think that is quite important going forward. There are Public Health Acts all over Australia, but Victoria's the only state where they've actually described that the law applies when emergency service staff might be affected. Queensland, it's in a police administration type act, and I'll show you in a minute that they've taken a slightly different approach, and it's a much older approach. The last three reflect a spate of laws that came in following a push from police service organisations, mainly in the last few years, and most of you are probably aware there is a push in New South Wales, which doesn't bode well for the rest of the country, hence the need for a national snapshot. So that's just an overview of the, as usual, Australian design of laws, hodgepodge, very hard to talk about it succinctly because it's a little bit all over the place. But you can see down the bottom that in Queensland, I wouldn't normally put that in brackets, but victims of sexual offences and serious assaults are the primary focus of these laws. So they are more for DNA testing after an assault, but their laws may also apply to people who've been exposed to bodily fluids soon after an offence, which might include first responders. So what are the risks from occupational exposure involving some kind of bodily fluids landing on someone? We're talking outside healthcare, so hospitals, you know, there are all kinds of policies and procedures in place which are actually very different from these ones that have come in. So we're talking, as I said, about emergency services, but mainly police. I did that instead of having morning tea. It's supposed to be an upside-down cascade. I don't know if it works. We can talk about that later, whether that's effective. But basically, a very small proportion of the population in Australia has HIV. So one of those people then has to be involved in an incident during which bodily fluids that can transmit HIV land on the police officer. Then it has to be the type of risk event where transmission is actually possible, and we know from the expert consensus statement on HIV in the context of criminal law and all kinds of research that there is a negligible to no possibility of transmission with most of the acts we're talking about. But we also know that if you're looking at a population, the risk is actually decreasing as more people with HIV have a low or undetectable viral load. And then there's PEP. So soon after an event, if someone can get PEP, it is highly likely that they will not get HIV. And that is why emergency services personnel are not acquiring HIV through occupational exposure. What? You're kidding. No, it's true. There have been no cases of HIV transmission to emergency services personnel as a result of occupational exposure since 2002. We actually had to dig to find that, which I was really amazed that we didn't already. No, maybe some of you did, but most of us didn't. And that is something that going forward we need to dig a bit more. That data's from Kirby. If you look back at the last or the one before National Surveillance Report, you will see that there is a suggested exposure, but when they dug further, it was not occupational. So that's from our National Surveillance data. And what we now need to do, I think, is go to our health departments and see whether they can tell us what kind of setting the 2002 exposure was in and work back so that we can really see, has there ever been an exposure or transmission in this context? So audit findings. We looked at the period since the newer laws have come in, And what you see there is an overview, which basically shows that the threshold or trigger for testing is very low. So it's about suspecting something may have happened. It's likely someone believes something. And I'm not a lawyer, but no doubt that's because you don't want to have to prove that there was contact before you can go down this path. But they're low, and I've put in italics every time the word saliva appears, which is, of course, extremely frustrating given we know that HIV cannot be transmitted through saliva, including when small quantities of blood are there. And in fact, for transmission to be even possible, there are a whole range of criteria you can all read, but that is from the expert consensus statement on the science of HIV in the context of criminal law, recently authored by 20 of the world's leading scientists in this area. So the low threshold then is really exacerbated by the problem that decision making is often by people who are not expert. So it's often police, and then in Northern Territory and Western Australia, if a person is a child or they lack capacity to consent, it has to go before a magistrate, which is really great because I'm really like a protective person. However, I'm just not sure why they deserve to have that level of scrutiny of circumstances and no one else does. And then in South Australia and Victoria, it goes before a magistrate if force is required, which is also fraught because if you're in the police station and they say, we have an order and you must give blood, you probably don't know that actually you don't have to. It's only when you refuse that it will be sent before a court. So I think that's looks good on paper. I don't know how that one plays out. So we then have this issue that decision making doesn't routinely allow procedural fairness. So that's like a synopsis of the slide that we just looked at, because in Northern Territory, South Australia and WA, most people will have their testing approved by a senior police officer who is not involved in the incident. So they've put that protection in place. And what that means is there is no opportunity to explain yourself or present any kind of defence about why perhaps testing isn't appropriate. And there's no third party to also decide whether that level of state intervention is warranted. I have to say, I'm probably preaching to the converted. Mandatory testing is a really considered quite a basic infringement of various legal and human rights. So it's pretty hard, heavy hitting. Detention is not time restricted in those three states. You can be detained for as long as reasonably necessary to make the order and also to do the test. Use of force is allowed. All states allow force or reasonable force. As I said before, Queensland, SA, Victoria, you need a court order. Northern Territory and WA, it's only if it's a child or unable to give consent. There are hefty criminal penalties in three of those states. I find that really amazing that it's not like $1,000 or $2,000. Like they really are considerable. So there's no time limit, use of force, criminal penalties apply. But what is also highly concerning is the threat of the use of those is it's force in itself. So they can be used to leverage compliance, which, you know, really is questionable whether consent has been provided at all. And whether the person who thinks they might have just consented may not be aware that legally that's not actually considered consent. Obviously, it's at odds with the national HIV strategy in terms of testing being voluntary, performed with informed consent, conducted ethically, and being beneficial to the person being tested. That concept is completely absent from any of these laws or practices. And here it's useful to note that in Victoria, a person who the laws... The approach is different, so it's basically avoid mandatory testing if it is at all possible, make sure that the person has been offered counselling, and every effort has been made to resolve any concerns the person may have regarding testing, because we all know testing is actually highly constructive and good. It's not problematic in itself. It's only the way it's dropped in here that has made it such an issue. So what we identified was many structural flaws in the system in relation to their implementation and monitoring. clinical context. So we talked to numerous healthcare practitioners, and basically in varied ways people said that, well, including someone working for a police service, a doctor working for a police service, saying they would not agree to test a person who refused to consent, particularly where use of force is involved, for a whole range of reasons, including it's not safe for the patient, it's not necessarily safe for the healthcare practitioner if someone's flailing about, it might not benefit the patient, and generally goes against ethical codes of medical practice. So we have concerns about how these laws can be applied in a clinical setting, but we also have a concern that by the time that testing happens, the coercion that has gone on may not be apparent to the healthcare practitioner, certainly not apparent to the pathology people or the people who are delivering results. And here it is worth noting that in Western Australia, an affected police officer can overrule this physician who is making the risk assessment, which is really, in law, that's a very surprising thing to discover. So there is a disconnect between laws, guidelines and practices, which looks very neat up there, but when we were looking at the material, it's actually quite mind-boggling trying to put the systems together, because I didn't do methodology because we had a short amount of time, but we put in freedom of information requests to get materials from the government, which included things like standard operating procedures and guidelines to try and work out how these would be practiced. And in WA, the law says that ongoing detention and use of force is to be used to get the result. But the police service's standard operating procedures say if a person's not willing to comply, they're to be informed they've committed a criminal offence, issued a summons, and released immediately. More to be asked about that. The systems really lack a transparent and accessible mechanism. So we're launching a report. We've done our very best, but boy, oh boy, till the very last day, we were trying to extract information from the various states about how these things are being done. There's no key point of entry. I want to say I talked to a lot of public service servants, including police. Every single person was really courteous and really helpful, which is really reassures faith. But people just didn't know. People actually actively tried to find out who we should be talking to, including people in health and police, and found it very difficult. FOI, in some states, trying to find out this stuff just doesn't fit the terms of FOI requests. In others, same problem, they didn't know where to look. In the Northern Territory, they record incidents on a computer by incidents. There is absolutely no way to extract the data for them or us. So basically, I don't know what data is being collected in different states, but it's certainly not the approach we would normally take in health if we were looking at this issue. And no states were provided information on certain things that we asked in our FOI request, like what was the exposure that triggered the testing. The testing that includes a range of diseases, we're interested in HIV, but it would seem, if you're not looking at the risk in terms of exposure, you're probably testing for everything. As I've said, states have minimal or no monitoring. We don't know if the data exists. We know in NT they actually told us we cannot tell you. Queensland just kept trying to find it and we never actually got to the end of it. Not just FOI, I tried numerous parts of government and we couldn't get anywhere. So I find that lack of structure really, would I find it amazing. When they were talking about bringing this in, we said this was one of our concerns and it would seem valid, because it suggests, so they're obviously disinterested in the experience of the person being tested, that's quite clear. But it also suggests a lack of interest in whether it's useful. And the whole point of the people pushing for it was supposed to be that it would be useful. So how are they going to measure whether it meets their criteria? There's a real lack of understanding of the type of systems we use in health, and there's a disregard for cost. So in WA, a third of the cases were regional, where someone has to be escorted in a police car by armed guards to designated hospitals. So that's got to cost a little money. I'm going to go quickly because I can see the clock. There's a lack of an interface between health and police, where we would really like to know that the health departments are being kept informed, even if we can't be informed of everything that the governments are doing. So what did we find? How many times have the laws been used? A lot in WA. So I'm just going to go back to Victoria. So it's a public health system. They report annually, and they're not using their public health orders very often either, so that's moderate. But these laws are basically haven't been used in WA, where specialist medical physicians are making, you know, the chief health officer or whoever are making the decision about whether they're needed. But at WA, whoops, the circle slipped. In 4 years, it's been used almost 400 times. So it's now near the end. Are we up to 500? I don't know. Who are these people? It's weird because they're not people with HIV being tested. They're people being tested for HIV. So we have no idea of how to collect anything about their experiences. And it's completely different from what they said when they brought the laws in, when they said there'd been 147 incidents in 2013 and only a small number of these incidents would need testing. It suggests that everyone who does anything is being tested. Okay, so these were the questions we asked that we were unable to extract data about. We particularly want to know what type of exposure triggers testing. Has there been a case of a person tested positive for HIV? We don't know. Has there been a case of transmission? We know there hasn't because we have those other slides. We've made recommendations. You can read them in the report. They're pretty basic. They're fairly unsophisticated because what we really need now is some discussion about where we go. Who do you think's being tested? So do you think that the middle-class annoyed person who has three glasses of wine on a Friday night and gets busted by the police and spits is being tested? No, it's the same people who are always caught up in the system, and I actually find it a little distressing that we're unable to really galvanise what we need to address the way these laws are being used and who we suspect they're being used against. Next, what's our strategy, people? Where are we going from here? What are the compelling messages that will change minds? Who are our allies? Because I would be thinking perhaps Aboriginal legal services, civil rights people, you know, people working with people who are homeless might actually be happy to come on board and work with us on this. And mainly, when do we start? Thanks, everyone.